This is Edge Cases. I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Wolf French.
And what's our topic this week, Wolf?
Conflict-free data types.
Uh-huh. I object. I have a conflict.
You know, I thought I was going to stump you. I thought you'd have actually nothing, no funny humor. I forget if I got you what sequential consistency or not, but yes, I figured there'd be no humor to be had in that.
Well, I mean, good humor, we could argue about. But no, I kind of psyched myself up now. I'm like, okay, I gotta come up with something quick. And then quick, what am I gonna do? And so you'll probably just get lousy immediate humor rather than stunned silence from now on. That will be our new pattern. So what are we talking about again?
Conflict-free data types.
Ah, there we go. Mm-hmm. Alrighty. So I have a bit of follow-up. And Wolf, if I remember correctly, and you're usually the one who doesn't remember what we did in the last episode. It's been 2 weeks now, so it's a little longer for me to remember. But I remember you saying, hey, if you have this thing that we can use to show live views, why don't you put that up? And so I did. After our last episode, I put up a project called Big Fan because, and this, there was a recent XKCD about somebody with a windmill. I'm not even sure I'm going to put a link to that in there. But in any case, it was a joke that I thought was funny. So there's a view that animates a little half step at a time. So it's kind of a little windmill. And so if you run this app on your iPhone, that's what you'll see. But if you, and it's got a framework as well as an app. So it should look correct in live views on Xcode 6. Mm-hmm. But if you run it, it doesn't actually show anything. Mm-hmm. But as you noticed afterwards, it pegs all the cores on your machine when you run it. So it must actually be running that timer that's going off every half second or so. It's just not showing the results in the UI. So I don't know what they're doing. They're doing something weird. But it shows the colors correctly. It shows kind of a snapshot of it, but it doesn't show the animation, which was what I was interested in when I put that together. So you can try that out as well. I'll put the link in the show notes. It's github.com/apontius big fan, but I'll also put a link in the show notes. Mm-hmm. And that's my follow-up. Okay. So over to you.
I can imagine that it's probably doing some sort of like grabbing the initial pixels from the frame and then just basically blast those into whatever an interface builder. But there's also that like that IO surface API, which I haven't personally used, that allows you to do like shared memory kind of screen sharing. Like we can basically have another process and have draw into your own window in your local process, but it shows up in the frontmost process type stuff.
I know they do that. Is there a public API to do that?
I don't know if it's public. I believe it is. I think Gus Mueller is using something with that with Acorn in order to do like the screen grabs, where you can like grab all the windows as textures and maybe not as textures. I'm really talking my hat here because I don't know the underlying things, but you definitely can grab the pixels of other windows and then he can import them as separate layers, which is pretty powerful stuff. Yeah. I think that's IO surface, but I'm not sure.
That's for Mac, though. That's presumably not for iOS.
Right, right. But my point is the simulator type stuff. It could potentially leverage that, because obviously that's on the Mac.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. So that was me pretty much expressing my ignorance on the topic. So now I'll express my first flub. I said conflict-free data types. I should have said conflict-free replicated data types. So that I feel I've kind of deprived you of a word that you could use to leverage into bad humor. So I apologize for that.
But that probably would have been too many words. I wouldn't have known where to start.
This kind of space. Actually, I have to say conflict-free data types actually sounds a lot better than conflict-free replicated data types. Your eyes glaze over in the middle of that phrase.
Well, it's too many concepts together.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
But so I'm assuming you will describe it.
Yes, I will. And so we can get started. So I've been thinking about this a while, about how to best structure this talk. And so I have kind of a loose framework of how to talk about this stuff. And I'm not altogether satisfied with it, but this is what 2 weeks of me kind of noodling on it and rewriting stuff gets us. This is all you're going to get. Yes, people of Edge Cases, the sole reason why we didn't record last week is because I wanted to make this episode better. So I guess I have some pressure to make this episode at least a little bit more coherent than usual, but no promises. So there's the I decided that usually in this type of topic, I like to go historical, where I kind of go linear a long time, because I find that it really helps me where I kind of think about how each person kind of lived in a certain era of what they knew and what they did know and what the pressing problems of the day and how they solved it. And it's kind of a step-taking approach. But and that I find kind of incremental and pretty easy to follow. It's kind of like when you don't squash commits on Git, so you can actually watch your software being created, which I know is apparently like a TAS versus spaces kind of hot topic thing, but I definitely on the history preserving side of things there. But anyway, this one is going to be, I'm going to go kind of nonlinear here, but I think it works, so let's get started. So there's this thing called the CAP theorem. And there is a little bit of controversy whether it's a theorem or whether it's simply a conjecture. It does have a proof, so everyone seems to call it a theorem. And the one blog post I read that says it is a theorem, I wasn't all too convinced about it, so I'll just go with what everyone calls it, the CAP theorem. And CAP theorem was put forth as a conjecture by Eric Brewer in the year 2000 in his talk symposium on principles of distributed computing. And the nice thing about what Eric did is that he basically named different concepts in distributed databases. And he also talked about the trade-offs therein. So the CAP is CAP, and it stands for Consistency, Availability, and Partition Tolerance. Consistency is the idea that all nodes see the same data at the same time. Availability, this is straight up from Wikipedia. Availability is a guarantee that every request receives a response about whether it was successful or failed. And partition tolerance, the system continues to operate despite arbitrary message loss or failure of part of the system. And so the thing is, so you have these three facets, the consistency, availability, and partition tolerance. And the idea here is that they kind of work against each other. And the idea is that it's kind of like the project management triangle, where you have the quality, cost, and schedule. You get to pick any two.
Right.
So CAP theorem is basically that you have consistency, you have availability, you have partition tolerance. What trade-offs are you going to make? Because you can't have them all the time. And so it turns out that Eric Brewer wrote an article. It ended up on InfoQ. I don't know if it was initially for InfoQ, but it's called CAP 12 Years Later, How the Rules Have Changed. And in that one blog post, the article, whatever it is, he had this nice little paragraph here that helps. I think it's a really good introductory, better one than what I found on Wikipedia, on the concept of CAP. And I think it helps kind of frame it. So I'll just quote him here. The easiest way to understand CAP is to think of two nodes on opposite sides of a partition. Allowing at least one node to update state will cause the nodes to become inconsistent, thus forfeiting C, or the consistency. Likewise, if the choice is to preserve consistency, one side of the partition must act as if it is unavailable, thus forfeiting A, or availability. Only when the nodes communicate is it possible for to preserve both consistency and availability, thereby forfeiting P, which is the partition. The general belief is that for a wide area system, designers cannot forfeit P, and therefore have a difficult choice between C and A. So when you think about it in that way, the terminology is kind of weird, kind of foreign, maybe kind of academic.
It is a little unlike other terminology I've heard.
Yeah. So if you think of partition and partitions as basically saying the network is down or flaky, or if you just think of it in terms of a distributed system where you have an iPhone that has its database and you have your server that has this database and they need to talk. When the cell network goes down or goes flaky, that's also a partition. So it's kind of this generic kind of academic term, but so that's how you should think. You just can think about what would it mean if these nodes need to talk to each other to kind of all have the same idea of the same data, and now they can't talk, but they want to accept updates or update. You have some choices you have to make. So you can think about it like, imagine you had a database server that's storing all your data. And you're sending it, you're telling it to increment an integer or something like that. Maybe incrementing a bank account. That tends to be a favorite among the kind of transactional ideas, the kind of transactional scenarios. And so you're like, okay, we kind of need a hot spare, or we want to have a live backup or something like that. So we'll run two instances of that database. So they're happily talking amongst each other, sharing their data and all that. And now there's the quote-unquote partition, network partition, which basically lets us say that a cat trips over Ethernet cable. Or, probably chews through it. That'd probably be more realistic. did you want to put a cat reference there, or should I keep going?
Well, the cat, they would probably unplug it by glumping through, chasing something.
Oh, okay.
That's the most realistic scenario I can come up with.
Okay. And so now you send you want to increase the bin count by $100. So now the node can no longer, the first node can no longer see the second node. So at that point, you need to have a trade-off. It can be consistent in that it can refuse the transaction, or it can be available and accept the transaction. And you can't have both. And then there's the entire thing about partition recovery, that what happens once these systems come back online. I'll talk a little bit about that later in the real world. But yeah, it's very interesting stuff. The nice thing about the CAP theorem is that it provides kind of this conceptual framework to name the various competing trade-offs and elements of a distributed data storage system. So Leslie Lamport is a big name in distributed systems. He won the Turing Award, so props to him. And he lives in Mountain View, California. He's still alive. And this is what's actually pretty cool about our field, is that like a lot of these intellectual giants who've defined like how modern computers work are like still alive and walking among us and all this, and it's really kind of rare for a field like ours that has like so much influence, that it's so very young, and that like the people who've defined so much are just still among us, and so that's pretty awesome. So Leslie Amport, in Edge Case 73, I talked about sequential consistency, and he actually came up with the idea of sequential consistency. He also defined the Byzantine Generals problem, Bitcoin, it uses its breakthrough is actually a solution to the Byzantine Generals problem. And but for our purposes tonight, the thing that we're interested in are two things: the Lamport timestamps and Paxos. So first, I told you that he's big into distributed systems, and so there's this entire thing about like figuring out order of operations and causality in distributed systems, about what happened when. Not so much what happened when, as it's more of what happened before and after. And it sounds like maybe academic distinction there, a distinction without difference, but it actually. We tend to look at systems as kind of like a godlike way that we can look at a system and we can decide we actually know the quote unquote true ordering of things and how they happened and whether they actually were sequential or were they concurrent, and we can draw these timelines about how things quote unquote really happened. And the thing about Leslie Lamport is that he kind of had an intuitive understanding of like relativity, and so he understands like it's all kind of relative based on your viewpoint on how these systems should how they see the world and how they should react and how they should interpret the world, and so that's actually that kind of like intuitive understanding allowed him to this kind of know where his peers are kind of basically screwing up in designing systems. So you kind of need to get stop this idea of you have this godlike view of actual facts on what happened when, and it's like, what can you actually talk about? And if you can make weaker guarantees, you actually get to have better trade-offs. So you can think of Lamport timestamps as essentially logical clocks. So they have nothing to do really about like the clock on the wall that counts a second every second that keeps on ticking away. Instead, they tend to be integers, and they tend to be based on internal events and external events. So that's when they increment. So you could have a logical clock that does increment for a week, then it maybe gets incremented 100,000 times in a couple seconds, depending on what type of internal and external events it has to deal with and has a timestamp. Now, you can almost think like relational databases have this concept of primary keys, and primary keys are typically integers that are incremented. And you can almost think of like primary keys as the like poor man's logical clocks. The idea is that's kind of have this thing that keeps on incrementing that kind of is tied to a row of data, but it's internal as it's basically for kind of internal housekeeping, and it's and you can't obviously expose your primary keys, and you actually do share your timestamps. But the idea here is that you have this this thing that isn't tied to the real world. It's more for internal bookkeeping, and that's kind of important. So each system, each node maintains its own local clock. So if you had our before we had the two nodes of a database backup, live and a slave, or maybe it's just we might have three nodes in a more distributed system. It's or they could just be pure peers of each other type stuff. That each one would have its own logical clock, and usually these logical clocks start zero, and then for each thing. So if I did that, $100 deposit type thing, that would actually increment that internal timestamp. And then when the nodes all talk to each other, they send along their internal timestamp, copies of their internal timestamp. And through Leslie figured out how to figure out the ordering events based on these timestamps so you can compare them. And what's interesting is that there's no like God mode here. There's no, there's not us as a sysadmin looking down and looking inside the memory of every computer and deciding what the true reality is and how everyone needs to be updated in lockstep. Instead, each node just knows what it knows, which actually that's a lot of nodes and nodes in there, but you get the idea. And so it gets a message over the wire, and it looks at the timestamp it got from its peer, and then it knows its internal timestamp. And what it can do is it gets a partial ordering of events, that it knows it's an order of events, and it knows what message is thus received. And so it can figure out what it matters in terms of what it's keeping track of. And so it's important that there's no concept of happened when. It's more of a matter of causality. An extension to Lampert's timestamps is these things called vector clocks. And we've mentioned them before in edge cases. It was edge cases 24, making zibs look good. And
that's right, I remember that.
Yeah, and so revisiting that topic a little bit, but initially, I remember when I initially heard about it, I thought the vector in vector clocks had something to do with the direction of time. And it turns out the vector in vector clocks just means a vector of timestamps, which is kind of confusing to me, but it's just a really primitive way to talk about identifying the timestamp in each node. They just store them in a vector because you can access it, the first client will be client zero, the second client will be client one, and let's basically assign a ID to each node. But it could be a dictionary. It doesn't need to be a vector. So you could think of it as an array or whatever. So
it's just, like a vector as in like a standard library vector.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the vector is really confusing. And a lot of the stuff, the title, the conflict-free replicated data types, it's like there's a lot of like, I don't know, it's like this muck you have to get through of terminology of words that, it's almost like I think like the academics almost want to make it sound more substantial than it is.
Well, it's a jargon, and it's not our jargon.
Good. Yes. And so it's really simple concept is that every node not only has its own counter, its own local time, its own local logical clock, is that it also keeps a copy of every other node's logical clock.
Oh, no, really? Wow.
That's it. And so it's a simple concept. And so the idea is that when you send a message and when you're synchronizing with the other peers on the network, is that you include the entire copy of the local logical clocks, your local logical clock and every other logical clock you know about in the message.
That sounds a little duplicative.
It is duplicative, and that's one of the things we'll talk about later. But there are some efficiency concerns with this. So, but that's the magic behind vector clocks. Once you realize that every node is just basically copying around counters about what its local logical clock is, and is copying them to all the other nodes so that they can make sense of what happened when. It seems a lot more tractable. Leslie Lamport.
Well, it's very chatty. It's like a big gossip circle.
Oh, and there are actually one of the protocols is gossiped is in terms of a consensus algorithm. So yeah, pretty much. Lamport also invented the Paxos distributed consensus algorithm, which is a 2 to 3 3-phase commit. But an interesting story about Paxos is that it's so Lamport had the Byzantine generals problem, which is just, it has to do with essentially messaging and what happens when your acknowledgement packets might get lost or corrupted, or you might have enemies in your messages, stuff like that. The reason why he went with the Byzantine generals problem is that, oh, by the way, if you don't, I've learned all this because Leslie Lamport has a webpage and he listed all his publications, and you know, I think there's like 200 of them, all of them, and they're all, well, not all amazing, but a lot of them are amazing. And he also includes like a backstory on a lot of them. And he's been very prolific, and it's definitely worth your time just to scroll down his publications page and like just read it from top to bottom, because there's all sorts of great little stories and a lot of background, and it also kind of gives you a feel for like where the industry was in every decade, which is very impressive. But so the funny thing is that I think we've all heard of the dining philosopher's problem. And he kind of thought that Dijkstra was like, you know, that's why it got all popular, because it was cute, right? Even though it's maybe not that as important as other problems. So he's like, fine, I'm going to name mine the Byzantine generals problem. And it turns out he had great success in terms of getting the problem thought about by giving it that name. So he's like, with guns a-blazing with Paxos, that he's like, so you guys like stories, huh? Well, I'm going to give you stories. And so the name of the Paxos paper was, I believe it's called A Part-Time Parliament. And he basically writes it in terms of where he's this archaeologist and there's this lost Greek parliament, and how they decide things, and just and how they achieve consensus, and that's why it's named Paxos, is because it's named after this mythical Greek island, and he even created like bastardized Greek versions of famous computer science names to assign kind of like Plato style to assign different names to different ideas. And it even got to the point where when he gave talks about it, he wore an Indiana Jones style Stetson and a hip flask. And
nice.
What's really funny is that he said it was basically a total disaster. That he basically injected too much humor into it. That he would like quiz people after his talks, and like they remember the Indiana Jones, but they don't remember the algorithm.
Anything about it, for sure.
And it even got to the point where like he sent the paper to some friends who supposedly read it, and then a couple of months later he'd send them a question like, "Do you know any algorithms that solve this problem?" And like they didn't. So like yeah, this got overwhelmed in the humor. But you'd be surprised. These distributed systems guys are surprisingly fun.
So a certain value of fun.
Oh, it's come on. This is fun.
Not saying it's not my value of fun too. It's just
okay.
You know.
But
whimsy.
There we go. Back in the real world, is that consensus is really attractive because it gives you the C in CAP. In the ideal world, we would like that our systems be always available, always consistent. And problem is that consensus is a bottleneck. And there's this famous paper by, I guess it was more of a blog posting, by Gregor Hoppe, Hohpe, probably butchered that, called Starbucks Doesn't Use Two-Phase Commit. And later on, it was, I think, republished and added on to it for IEEE Software Design Magazine, and was given a more respectable title of "Your Coffee Shop Doesn't Use Two-Phase Commit." And I will quote the the interesting one little paragraph. There's a lot more detail, but this kind of gives the gist of it. Starbucks, this is from the original Starbucks paper, so we can actually mention the coffee shop.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Starbucks, like the other businesses is primarily interested in maximizing throughput of orders. More orders equal more revenue. As a result, they use asynchronous processing. When you place your order, the cashier marks a cup of coffee with your order and places it into the queue. The queue is quite literally a queue of coffee cups lined up on top of the espresso machine. This queue decouples the cashier and the barista and allows the cashier to keep taking orders even if the barista is backed up for a moment. It allows them to deploy multiple baristas in a competing consumer scenario if the store gets busy. And that's I'm sure I'm a complete freak here, but when I learned about multi-threading, it changed the way I did laundry because I saw things in a different way.
Really?
Seriously. Hopefully after you read this blog posting / paper, you might look at your local coffee shop a little bit differently, and you can see it in terms of queue processing, asynchronous queue processing systems instead of just a coffee shop. But I believe...
What if you don't like coffee?
Throw tea in there or whatever drink is. I guess you're probably a hard drinking man, so you probably
That's right. I'm off at the bar ordering 20 drinks and seeing how they fulfill it.
Explain a lot. So I believe that Lamport proved all consensus requires 2 to 3 message delays at minimum. So the idea here is that consensus is not free. You have to pay the piper. And the thing is that the consensus actually affects the A in CAP. Because if you're faster, you are more available. And the inverse is also true that if you're slower, you're less available. It's interesting how the consensus, you can see how the trade-off affects the C in CAP, affects the A as well. So the hotness really is nowadays is something called eventual consistency. Since we have this kind of this hard wall, the speed of light of the CAP theorem, maybe we can make some deals with the devil, and we can play some games, and we can make things more to our liking. And so eventual consistency is the idea that, yeah, we're going to be consistent eventually, that we can defer things, and if it... Like, a lot of these things are like Facebook likes, and if you and your friend are monkey clicking a bunch of Facebook like buttons, and you don't see, maybe you're missing 2 of the likes from your friends, that's not the end of the world. Reload the page, and you will see those 2 extra likes. So the idea is that on some of these systems, you can trade off things. I mean, if you're doing something like selling a scarce resource, like maybe an appointment, maybe you don't want to use eventual consistency for that type of thing, but for a lot of these things, you can kind of you can leverage the trade-offs. So Kyle Kinsbury did this excellent set of posts it's tagged under Jespin, as in Carly Rae Jespin. You might remember her from such songs as "Call Me Maybe," which, Andrew, I believe I'm the one who introduced you to "Call Me Maybe."
Yes, I could have used. More eventuality in you introducing that to me.
Oh, that's pretty good. Mm. We might have to call that one out and put it at the top of the show. That's pretty good. Yes. So I have to say that Kyle Kinsbury, it's just the type of corniness I love. It's really some of the, in my view, it's some of the best technical writing on their web, because the entire idea about kind of I should kind of talk about what the series is about. Is that the idea is that he builds a tool he calls Jespin he basically runs all these data stores through the ringer, and he actually creates VMs with multiple nodes, I believe usually 5, and then he starts inserting data, and he inserts the data in a way where essentially you have 5 nodes, and node 0. And they all are basically inserting integers. So node 0, count off by 5. So you have 5 nodes, and node 0 inserts 5, 10, 15. And then node 1 inserts 1, 6, 11, and this down the line. And so you have these 5 nodes, all of us inserting these integers. And at the end, Justbin says, okay, give me the numbers back. And it turns out they're all kind of overlapping and covering the entire integer space, it's really easy to see what data loss, if any, occurred. And so while all these nodes are doing these insertions into the data store, then he creates a partition. He separates 2 of the new nodes from the other 3. And then he rejoins them, and then he finds out if there's any data loss. And it's fantastic. So he ended up doing a talk about his Justbin series of blog posts at RICON East 2013, and I'll include a link to it. And it's worth your hour to watch this, because I almost don't want to spoil it for you, but he just goes down the line from Postgres to Redis to Mongo to React itself, which I believe RICON itself, I think, is the React conference. So that's, kind of biting the hand that feeds. But and he shows they all exhibit data loss, and when you actually put them through the test of the network partition and then restoring the network. And so it's pretty awesome, and pretty entertaining as well. I myself find the injection of – he injects a lot of pop music culture references into it, and a lot of corny puns, so it might get to you, Andrew, right then. At least I don't know if that's actually officially a pun, so you might have to be all pedantic about that, but he definitely is re-quotes some Lady Gaga and so forth. So and I think that's our first Lady Gaga reference in all of Edge Cases. So so I know of course we're coming up to the 100th episode, because that's the capper, that's the maraschino cherry on top. Yes, his entire thing about integrating like pop music culture references actually reminds me a lot of my atomicity paper from I think 1999, Concurrent Data Access Without Blowing Up, where I actually took the lyrics of cheesy 1980s songs and worked them into all my paper. And so I'll include a link to that if you actually want to see that. And so Kyle has – he had one of his blog postings on the Justbin tag has this nice little summary about kind of one of the problems with distributed systems, is that network errors mean I don't know, not it failed. Make the difference between success, failure, and intermediary explicit in your code and APIs. So the idea here is that it's easy to assume that you don't get a ACK packet back or something, and your TCP connection closes down, and you're like, oh, the other node has gone away, and it failed. No, actually, your packet may have landed, and what happened is that the ACK packet coming back was lost. And that goes back into the entire Byzantine's general problem, and I believe it's called the two generals problem in general, but you really can't know. Again, it's that the lack of a godlike view, where you don't know really what happened, and you need to soldier on. So you need to deal with the idea that I don't know what just happened, and your software needs to take that into account. So all of this, wow, 33 minutes into it, but I have, but now we're getting to what I promised at the top of the show, is a data type. That I'm very excited about, that is unfortunately seems to be not well known in the Apple community. It's kind of borne out that I don't know of any H2C implementations. I only know of a Ruby and JavaScript implementations of these. So that's kind of sad. But I'll start with, let's think about something simple that we want to replicate across various data storage nodes. And we'll just call this a register. And the register is simple. It's just you can get it and you can set it. And the thing is that these registers are an opaque value. So if we wanted to do something where we increment an integer on a distributed way, because it's opaque, you can't distribute them in a way that survives partitions. In a predictable way, and so you have a a couple of possibilities here. You can do the standard last write wins, where whoever wrote the last value into that register, that's the one that will be accepted. Or you can do something where you return all the concurrent values. And so that's kind of like what Dropbox does, where if you modify something on one Mac and you modify something on the other, and they were both disconnected, or maybe this one was connected and the other one wasn't, it won't just overwrite the document with the quote-unquote last one. Is that it will then put a conflicted copy right next to the other document, and it's up to you to decide. And basically the idea behind that is called a semantic resolution. That's up to the application, or in this case, a human, in the Dropbox case, that, okay, you've given me this data, there's some conflict here, this data is opaque to me, so now you get to decide which one's the real one. And you can let them live as long as you want, but typically you need to make a decision how to resolve this thing. So Mark Shapiro and a few other people, I guess et al., if I want to be all academic, wrote this fantastic paper called A Comprehensive Study of Convergent and Cumulative Replicated Data Types. And I'll include a link to that. There is an outdated paper floating around there, too, so I'll make sure I'll include a link to the latest one that at least I know of. And Mark Shapiro... Well,
you could include both, and then you would be...
Yeah. There we go. Mark Shapiro also did a talk in Microsoft Research, and I recommend watching that. Sean Cribbs, who's one of the authors of React, which is one of the databases I mentioned, did a talk at Berlin Buzz something called Eventually Consistent Data Structures, and I'll include a link to that. In general, what I would recommend is that you watch Sean Cribbs' talk on it first, then you could watch Mark Shapiro's talk, and then maybe read the paper. I found that even though I was really interested in the topic, I found the paper really hard to get started with. Once you have get spoon fed kind of the basics in the beginning, it kind of gives the brain the structure to really power through it. So that helps a lot. And then it became much more trackable. So the idea behind this is that you have these replicated data types, and the idea here is that these are data types that converge no matter what order you modify them in. And they come in two flavors, and this is kind of messed up and confusing, but so the general term for this is CRDT, and the C can stand for one of three things. It can stand for convergent, it can stand for commutative, or it can stand for this conflict-free. So conflict-free pretty much is like the generic term for both those. So if you don't want to actually call out whether you're talking about the convergent or the commutative, you just say conflict-free. So that's what I mentioned at the top of the show. But so they come in two flavors. And the convergent is uses state. And it's pretty easy to work around. So the vector clocks I mentioned before, where you're kind of storing the logical clocks of all your peer nodes on each node, that's a kind of a state way to think about things. The other way, and the nice thing about that is that it has weak messaging requirements. So if you have disconnected operations going on a lot, that helps a lot. The commutative one is operations based, and basically it kind of requires a reliable broadcast mechanism. And one thing I learned from Mark Shapiro's talk is that these actually can be expressed in terms of one another. So he recommends actually thinking about it in terms of the convergent state-based way of thinking, and then perhaps implementing it in terms of the commutative operations-based way. Or most problems, it's easier for us to think of in terms of state-based thing. But in terms of implementation efficiency, if you can assume a reliable broadcast network, then you can actually implement it in terms of commutative. So let's start with a simple concept again, the kind of the replicated integer that we talked about with the register before, that we had problems with conflicting and last write wins and concurrent values and all this. So the idea here is very similar to kind of like the vector clocks kind of idea. But he basically builds a basic data structure called a G counter. And the G in the G counter stands for grow only. So the idea is that you have this counter, this replicated counter that can only be incremented. And that sounds like, it doesn't sound very useful. But there are actually places to use it, you know, like fave counters or whatever. And from there, he builds on to a bunch of different things. But it's probably not a good idea to try and explain it, how this stuff works without visual aids. So I recommend actually watching, especially Sean Cripps' talk. He's high level, includes the diagrams. That's also in the paper. The paper seemed to be used a lot in his diagrams, which pretty much the same diagrams. But he kind of walks you through a timeline of how these operations take place and data stored by which node. And it's pretty straightforward once you realize that everyone has a copy of everyone else's data. And so it can then just basically compare integers to decide what really happened and when concurrent updates happened and stuff like that. So the idea here is that when you go to add, that you're not just incrementing an integer and you're done because you've mutated your state at that point. And if you thought about it, it's like if you just kind of like broadcast increments across a network and then you have connect another node, is that it might get multiple increments and that would be incorrect. So the increments have to be unique. So maintain a list of every increment that comes in, say, okay, I got another increment, and you tag it. And you use vector clocks to make sure these happen in the right order, although it's less of an issue with grow-only counters. And at the end of the day, you can make sure that even if a node got the same message twice, it won't end up incrementing twice when it shouldn't. It only increments at once. So once you have a G counter working, which sounds like a very basic thing, but it has a few tricky semantics to it, and unfortunately, those were all with the CRDTs. Those have been solved. So once you have a G counter, then you can grow that. Well, if that's the wrong term, I shouldn't say grow. You could extend that to be what's known as a PN counter, or the positive and negative counter. And internally, it's implemented as a pair of G counters, one for positive increments and one for negative increments. So now you see how these building blocks kind of start building up on each other, that you can build larger data structures out of them. And then you get into things called the sets, where you can use to build containers, maps, graphs, and pretty much any nested data structure. And so sets have two operations, add element and remove element. And again, they really kind of go fine-grained on this stuff. And that's why you start to realize what the title of the paper means, a comprehensive study of convergent and commutative replicated data types. It's that this paper, a lot like the Eric Brewer and how important the CAP theorem was to actually name all this stuff, that's really the genius of the Mark Shapiro, of Mark Shapiro, is that he and his associates went through and these ideas were kind of floating around, and he gave names to all of them. And he also then extended them to work and to build these conflict-free data types. So it is essentially a survey of the field, but he also did some original work as well. And basically he's given us a vocabulary to talk about this stuff, which is very powerful. If you can't talk about things to actually figure out the trade-offs and such. So much like the G counter was a grow-only counter, he defines the idea of a G set, which is a grow-only set, where you can only add elements. And then, again, it's not too useful, but it's good for if you want a list of happened in all time, but you can use that as a building block for other types. He also defines a two-phase set, which is comprised of two G sets for adding and removing. Much like the PN counter had two G counters in there, one for positive increments and one for negative increments, a two-phase set has the same thing, two G sets underneath it. And the problem with a two-phase set is that once something's been removed, it can never be added again because of the way how it works. There is a special case. There is a way to work around that with tombstone where you can So when you remove something, that's what ends up basically becoming a tombstone. That it's a marking of something that's gone away that won't ever be resurrected again. Fortunately, there are ways to, if that isn't to your liking, you can make different policy decisions and have it so that things can be added again. And so there's a lot of implementation detail here, but it's not that bad. And I should just keep moving on because I'm running out of time. It's 45 minutes. There's a USET, which is a guarantees that things are unique. And okay, I'm running out of time here, so I'll skip some of these. But I'll just mention that there's the popular one that I won't have time to get into is the OR set, which is the observed removed, and it's probably the most useful of them. It works much like what you'd think a normal set would work like, except it's based on conflict-free technology. And you also can do things like graphs. And so this all kind of works up to what Mark Shapiro calls strong eventual consistency. And he actually claims in his video that he solves CAP there. And I say he actually supports CAP there. The CAP theorem, that I think he's kind of watering down the definition of consistency there, but you know, he's a smart guy. I'll give him some slack on that, but I'm not altogether sold on it. And with the strong eventual consistency, if you use these kind of weird limited data structures and use them on building blocks on each other, what you get is that you get to do fast and responsive local updates without any consensus synchronization. There's no such thing as conflicts, so you don't. So there cannot be. You don't need any consensus algorithm or Paxos or something like that. And so you don't even have things like rollbacks because there's conflicts can't be. If you structure your data right, you don't have conflicts in the first place. And we'll skip this huge part right here, and I will talk about an edge cases 24 making zips look good. I did mention operational transforms before, and so I want to kind of compare operational transforms to CRDTs. So operational transforms are way more complicated to implement. I'm pretty sure it was on that Wikipedia page where they talked about how the algorithms behind operational transforms, like you have to make a lot of policy decisions about how things are going to go down in the cases of conflict. In Google Wave, which was an operational transform-based system, they said that it would take 2 years to implement, and it was so complicated that if they had to rewrite it again, it probably also would still take 2 years. That's because getting through all the cases takes a heck of a lot of thought and a heck of a lot of code. The downsides for CRDTs, as you mentioned, Andrew, is that they are essentially inherently inefficient, both from the idea that you're passing around extra data in your messages. They're also inefficient in terms of how much data you have to store, because you're kind of storing not the history of, you're storing like the histories of these values, as they state. So you end up having to use like garbage collection essentially to reap the outdated values, so that if an old node comes by and says, "Hey guys, you know, I've been away on vacation for a while. What's the new data?" You have to make some decisions there, like, "Oh, are you just going to say, sorry, dude, I don't care if you have some updates there. We're not going to accept that anymore because we didn't want to have to store your last couple terabytes." Or if your data set is, you know, if the elements are comparatively small, you could say, "Oh yeah, we're going to store all data forever," and so that becomes like a business's decision. It also depends on how dynamic your nodes are coming and going. So if things like the React database, where you have like you fire up 5-8 nodes at a time, and these are the only nodes on the planet that are dealing with this data set, you're very much in control of that lifetime. If you're doing things like replication with iPhone apps, obviously those can come and go all the time, and you might never see one again, or maybe someone put iPhone in the drawer for a few months and then fire it back up. So you have to decide then what that means and what the trade-offs are. And that's it. We're already 50-minute mark, but I have more to say, but I'm pretty much out of time.
Okay. Well, so you talked about things being conflict-free. Can you? I'm not sure I completely understood how they're conflict-free. Can you summarize that? Like, if I have two updates that came from two different clients, which say make this change, and they both say make a change, but the change is different. How is that resolved in general, if there is a general explanation for these kind of conflict-free data types?
Yeah, it's
complicated.
It's not complicated. It's one of these things where you have to build up from these very small little steps and build up from there. I mean, the G counter, right? It's like this really pathetic data type. But yeah, so the idea is that you have a copy of data, and I have a copy of the data, and I mean, we won't be able to, if we're, like I said, the things with like if we're like trying to book the same haircut appointment for the same person, that's a scarce resource. We're not going to get the same time slot at the same time. That's, you know, by definition, that can't be made conflict free.
Right.
But if you're doing things like what's some of the use cases here? I have this in another window. Social graphs, web page visits, shopping carts. These are like buttons, fave buttons. These are all things that can be actually implemented in terms of CRDTs, where you're kind of dealing with, I don't know, maybe delta type values.
Right.
But I mean, even things like, you know, social graphs, like who's following who, like that can actually be implemented in a way where you can distribute the data in a way that is conflict free.
Right. The problem that Facebook has is that all of its users want to change the database all at the same time and possibly quickly in succession. So I say I want to follow, you know, you, or I want to follow somebody else, and then I change my mind and I don't want to follow you anymore. Mm-hmm. And I do that five more times while other people are also trying to follow you and not follow you. Mm-hmm. And they have to, at the end of the day, and all these messages are coming into their server, not necessarily in the right order.
Right.
Or coming in at exactly the same time so that, mm-hmm, you can't tell who goes first and who doesn't.
Right.
And at the end of the day, they want a database which is correct. Mm-hmm. And so it sounds like the way that you can set up the data types in such a way that for a certain value of correct, that will give you the correct values at the end of the day because of how they're storing extra data to make sure that if something which seems like an apparent conflict winds up not being a conflict because they've got extra data which lets you resolve those issues.
That's exactly it, yeah.
All right, then. Mm-hmm. No, I actually don't completely understand it, but you're going to provide some links so that we can get a good handle on this without having to watch 50 hours worth of video.
Only asking you, yeah, just watch Sean Cribb's thing for a video for the kind of the background on it, and then make sure you watch the Kyle Kinsbury. That's for the hilarity of it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So that's it.
That's it
for this time. All right. Thanks, everybody, and we'll see you next time.